Welcome to For the Love of Weather podcast. This is the podcast where we discuss the Earth's atmosphere and how we're all connected through the weather and climate. We are bringing you a very special episode today, all the way from the Blue Earth Summit in Woolwich. We've had some really interesting conversations and we have learned a lot. And we just hope that you enjoy this episode of just some mini episodes that we put together while we've been here.
So our next guest is Avery. Avery, can you introduce yourself? Tell us what it is you do, your name, title, everything that you do.
Sure thing. Hi, I'm Avery Johnstone. I'm a manager in KPMG's Global Decarbonization Hub, where I focus on just transition. And I also have the great privilege of leading Leaders 2050, which is a KPMG-led external-facing network for young professionals who are interested in climate, energy transition, and ESG.
So we were at your talk earlier. It was incredibly interesting, but you showed us a map, sort of a 3D experience, and actually that was the results of a study, a really interesting way to show something. So the results of all of these questionnaires that you had done. Can you tell us a little bit about where all that came from, what it was about, and where we can find it?
Yeah, no, very happily. So if you go to www.kpmgleaders2050.com, you can see our flagship digital experience. And what we really aim to do is we put out a survey earlier this summer, and we had just under 1,000 respondents from over 55 countries, all young professionals, you know, between ages of 18 and 35. We usually don't use an age cutoff because I never want to exclude anybody from our study, especially when women take a lot of time off during their career for parental leave. So we never want to self-select women out of this process, but about 18 to 35 is the age range that we chose. Really trying to understand young professionals' perspectives and experiences within their own organizations on climate sustainability and social impact, and also what the business risk of those feelings and perspectives are. So really trying to create a data set that speaks to senior leaders in a way that resonates with them and actually communicates the impacts that young people are feeling and experiencing in their day-to-day roles into an actual business risk. And so we conducted this survey. It was kind of three parts, so we broke them into kind of observations, perspectives, and then reactions of this process, and put them into this digital experience where we partnered with Earth Minutes, who are a brilliant digital platform and communications agency based in the UK, and built this digital experience really to use visual storytelling and play as a means of communicating the data set that we were able to come across, and in a way that not just taps into people's, you know, thinking and changes their thinking, but also changes their feelings and changes their reactions to it. So how do we better storytell some of the client stories that we have and the impact that our work at KPMG kind of does, and whether that's an offshore wind farm, and as you'll see in the digital experience, we've got three: an offshore wind farm, a nature restoration project in Brazil, and a maritime shipping and transport kind of case study in India. And so we use the data set and we use the visual storytelling to kind of create an experience where people can go in and not just, you know, skim through an exact summary of a 40-page PDF that nobody's going to read, but actually really have an opportunity to play with the data, to understand it, and to follow the kind of storyline through the experience.
It was really great to see it visually. What's been the response to that report?
So it actually hasn't been launched yet, which is really exciting. We've been kind of soft launching it at events like this in New York Climate Week, as well as One Young World in Montreal earlier in September. Really starting to test the format, because we wanted to make sure it was a participatory approach to the design. So we've been working closely with Earth Minutes on that, but wanted to test it with senior and kind of young professional networks and groups of people to make sure it's user accessible. And so we've actually just been testing it over the last couple of weeks at events like this, to make sure that it's accessible from a wide variety of kind of accessibility needs, but also that it's resonating with the different audiences. I think one of the points I made on the session today was really knowing your audience and being able to tailor your message. What we've struggled with this digital experience is if we wanted to resonate several audiences, and so it's required a bit of testing and iteration to do that.
And for you, why is it important that young professionals' voices are heard in this area?
Well, there's, you know, as we see at COPs and as we see at New York Climate Week and all of these kind of large-scale convenings, even at Blue Earth Summit, there's this call to action from the private sector. The private sector has to mobilize. They've got all this capital that needs to be deployed for climate action. But we're not speaking to any of the young people that are going to inherit that decision-making or capital allocation power. And so there's a real disconnect between the decision makers who are making choices today in business and the young people who are going to ascend to those leadership roles. And so I personally feel like there's a really kind of a missing link of young professionals in that we're not gluing ourselves to buildings, we're not throwing paint on people, and we're working within systems of capitalism and working within kind of our wider global economy, but have this really unique ability to shift the perspectives within our own organizations. And so we're trying to create kind of power in that demographic to enable people who feel very deeply and feel the same way that activists do, feel the same way that people who are throwing paint do, you know, feel a very deep sense of purpose behind driving climate action, but don't otherwise feel like they have the means to contribute. And so it's a way of enabling young professionals who stand to inherit all of this power and capital to act now as opposed to waiting until they ascend to those leadership roles.
Tell me a little bit about your clients. So what are they looking for when they come to you?
That's a good question. I mean, a wide variety of different things. Depends on if we're talking about public or private sector clients. I think right now, a lot of it's being driven by the regulatory environment. And so there's a real need to understand the regulation that's either, you know, hitting them currently or coming down the pipeline at the global or at the local level. And so I think they're trying to grapple with how to do that at the moment. Some are thinking more strategically in terms of their long-term impact and actual transition planning, transition finance, and really trying to drive that in a much more proactive way. But I'd say we've got clients in all sectors at all stages of maturity. So it's hard to say kind of who's doing what or what they're coming to us with, because it's such a wide variety of maturity levels.
Your passion for this area really comes across when you speak about it. Where did that come from? What drives you to do what you do?
Oh, very good question. I've always been driven by impact. My background is in health policy and very much the kind of gendered side of health policy, so sexual and reproductive health and rights in particular. And I did a dissertation project when I was in my undergrad, and I spent a bit of time living and working in Guyana in Georgetown, which is a really interesting country geopolitically, from, you know, the sexual and reproductive health and rights and kind of consent education side, but also now with ExxonMobil and oil extraction. And so that's where all of this kind of compounded. I feel like it's sometimes hard to articulate, but I think about these challenges in a deeply interconnected, interwoven way, where climate change cannot be solved without gender equality, cannot be solved without health equity, cannot be solved without infrastructure. So there's, I think it's hard to think about it in silos. I think to one distinct experience of what inspired me, but I think learning and understanding how they all compact and compound one another just further drives my passion to solve them all, everything everywhere all at once.
Do you know, you just reminded me of Julia Kinsman. She's a sustainable travel writer, and we had a podcast with her. It changed my whole thinking of everything, but it's really interesting you talk about women's reproductive rights. Her whole thing is women and children suffer the most for climate change in one shape or form or another. Mm-hmm. It's really fascinating. It sounds like you're really well placed, because you're coming from a place of heart, but also a place of experience and a place of, like, really understanding the complexity of the problems, and perhaps knowing how complex they are and knowing that you don't have the answers makes you brilliant at your job. Do you know what I mean? Like,
well,
you don't know
you.
Absolutely,
I mean,
everything.
That's very kind. I think that
do
is
you know
the
what
thing.
I mean?
Because I would never seek to position myself as someone that knew everything, because it's not my lived experience. And so I think creating space for community, creating space for relationship development with people whose lived experience is on the front lines of climate change is so critical to bringing that understanding. And obviously what we were chatting about storytelling and diverse voices. But I think it is that, yeah, how do we bring that lived experience and storytelling and data is what it is to the minds and the opportunities that can change it? And how do you start to actually frame this in a way that people start to understand, like, a much better world is possible across all fronts, and that by doing things across all fronts, it actually accelerates progress? I think we've often heard, and it's not, you know, just business, but a lot of people say, oh, there's going to have to be trade-offs, or how can I focus on gender equality when I just need to get my, you know, emissions reporting done? I can only do one thing at a time. And I just sort of reject that approach. It's not to discredit how much people have to do or how onerous all of the reporting is. But again, it if you do it all at the same time, or if you mobilize kind of all together, you'll get there much faster, and you'll get there much more effectively and much more inclusively. And so I often will push back on senior leaders and be like, oh, I can only focus on one thing. I'm like, what a luxury. How nice is that for you to only be able to focus on one thing when, you know, single mothers in sub-Saharan Africa are migrating because with their children because of climate change. Like, they don't have the luxury to think about one thing at a time. So it's, I think, reframing that narrative and being able to bring that lived experience, again, not my lived experience, but being able to amplify the storytelling of others, is hugely critical in decision-making kind of business spaces, because they otherwise wouldn't necessarily be exposed to that. And I think that's where there's a real gap.
What's the one thing you wish everybody knew about what what you do. What's your one message?
My one message would be that as a young person, you don't have to be a full-time activist to impact change. And I think it's really important that people feel autonomy and feel power within their own organizations, institutions, educational institutions, that you don't just have to be, you know, a civil disruptor to have impact, and that you can use your skills, your education, your privilege, your positionality to impact things in all different ways. And that can look different for different people and should look different for lots of different people, but that mobilizing everyone is kind of what we need at this point. So we can't self-select out just because we exist in wider systems that challenge us.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you.
My name is Lindley Lewis and my official title is COO of Blue Earth Summit, and I'm one of the co-founders.
We were just, I basically just spitballing around ideas, and we knew that we were living, you know, our ethos was one that was focused on sustainability and prioritizing the outdoors. And we looked at it from a business perspective, and we just found that the whole scene was just so void of inspiration. You had corporates on one side boring everyone to tears with scope 3, ESG, absolute corporate mumbo jumbo, and it was really hard to follow, and it didn't put anyone along in the journey. And then you had climate activists on the other side who were actually making the whole thing very terrifying and scaring people, and then businesses didn't want to adapt because they felt that they were worried about getting put on the, you know, putting the head above the parapet, or worried about all the history that they're basically people were worried about getting called out for not doing it perfect. So we felt that there wasn't an event that was well positioned in the middle that took an inspiration, took a value of the outdoors, and we effectively just developed the idea. So we knew that the concept of the event was keynotes, workshops, panels, seminars, a sort of normal concept. We had the audience that we knew we could access of people who were inspired by the outdoors, who were interested in business, who wanted to find a better way forward, whether it was people or planet. And we decided, we knew we had an ocean background, but we wanted to focus more, not just exclusively about ocean. So at the time we were running a magazine called Wavelength. We considered, should we call it the Wavelength Summit? But actually we settled on Blue Earth Summit because we wanted it to be about land and cover topics such as food and make it much, you know, a much broader, effectively cover everything that's on the earth. And also, the sort of, I suppose, the missing piece, a friend of mine was in production, and he said, if you do this, we're kind of out of luck as well through COVID, we can produce it. So we just gave it a go and had a run at it, decided to launch it in Bristol. The Bristol Wave had just opened, so we spoke to them and said that we're looking to do this event, effectively a kind of, you know, Web Summit-esque, but all about sustainability with outdoors as inspiration. Yeah, hosted it in year one at a nightclub, which we converted into an amazing day venue. And we hosted day two at the Bristol Wave. So then that was the inspiration for people to come along, they can surf, they go running, and it sort of got going from there. So the first one, that was when I suppose the penny dropped, and we managed to get about 350 to 600 people along to that. The feedback was overwhelmingly positive. People loved it. They wanted to come back. And then in Bristol, we ran it, we moved venue. It got a lot bigger the next year in capacity and in attendance. And then in the third year, it grew more, and we were able to step back from it and understand, I suppose, or do the research a little bit more as to why do people come to this event? What are people looking to get out of it? You know, startups looking to get money from investors. And if that's the case, then you need to have more investors than you do startups. And then they get inspired by the brands. The charities are inspired by the talkers. They're there to learn. They're there also to raise money from the philanthropists. You then have the service economies on the side, your marketing, solicitors, management, accountants, those sort of organizations who are looking to engage and effectively sell their services to the brands. So we were really able to map the events out and try and focus on making sure that each different area within the event gets a return on investment. And that's the side that I concentrate on. My title now is COO, so I'm all about the operations. From the three partners, there's Guy, who's all about the business and facilitating investment, and Will is all about actually the vision, the trajectory that Blue Earth can go down.
So basically from year one to year three was just absolutely huge.
We were
backstage, and actually Deborah Meaden was somebody who's always, I found her fascinating. She's one of the first people to come out and be like, I'm only investing in sustainable business, which tells you there's future for it, and she's really, really positive. So how do you think about getting speakers? How far ahead do you have to think about who's going to talk? Who does all of that? What's your vision?
Yeah, well, the getting speakers, in it, we have people in the team that work year round on getting speakers, and you'll find that quite a lot of speakers here. I'm just trying to think of some off the top of my head, but Hugo Tycone, for example, they'll speak every year. You know, he's spoken from the first one, he's speaking now. We call those house favourites. You know, Keme is hosting this year, he hosted it in Bristol in year one. So it's kind of like all these things, it's like layering an onion. You know, it's like layers of an onion. You just, people make introductions, you got to follow up on conversations, you've got to constantly, we're always thinking about different ways of doing things. Also understanding our market and our purpose as we go along. So this year you would have seen there's much more of a focus around the B100, the businesses that are in there. And we think that as an event, that is our superpower. You know, those companies, those ideas, those innovations are what really make this event different. I think in the marketplace there's quite a lot of climate fatigue. There's a lot of ESG fatigue. We describe ourselves, you know, we're not another climate. We actually have the tagline, not another boring climate event, because there a lot of events just get it wrong. We're here to inspire, entertain and connect people. So yeah, I mean, event like this, there's obviously lots of different bits to organize, but when it's what you do and it's your focus, you know, that's just, it's just what you concentrate on. So we've got little spin-off events as well that are constantly feeding the community in different ways. So the summit is the big one, that's, you know, what, the festival circus. We have another event, which is the forum, which is just 40 businesses who are raising money. They've got to be raising 1 million plus, so they're all up to a certain scale. And then we get 250 investors along to that event. And over, it's a two-day event, and they're match made over those 2 days. So investors meet company, and that's all that happens at that event. So it's a very different kind of event to be at, because an event like the Blue Earth Summit, it's all about the kind of noise, the scale, the bravado, the impact and the kind of excitement and the energy. Whereas at the forum, it's all about the actually, do people have 16 genuinely meaningful conversations over 2 days? And if they do, the impact will happen. So yeah, we're always looking for different ways to do things, certainly never sitting still.
One thing I've really enjoyed this year, I've been to quite a few talks on the future stage.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that, because it's actually showing solutions, showing things that people can do or making a change. And that, for me, has been a real take-home message. It's been like, there are things that are being done. There are solutions out there. There are people that are trying to make a difference. So yeah, I've really enjoyed that this year.
Yeah, and that's all we want to be concentrating on is moving forward and not just highlighting the problem. Because you find that you hear that at quite a lot of events, you know, the amount of climate events you go to, and it starts off with, did you know the temperature of the oceans is going to rise by 1.5 degrees? Now we're an educated audience. People know that. So they don't need to get told that again. We need to work out how we're providing that solution. So yeah, on the future stage, you've obviously got trends, ideas, patterns, learnings that people can take home. And that's where we also like the businesses, because they're what we call solution-based businesses. So, and that's a slightly new kind of new area that we're in. And I think for the climate, for businesses to work and actually have an impact, it can't just be an alternative. It's got to be a better solution. And that's what we're constantly seeing. You know, if it's a service, it's really got to be cheaper. It's got to be more scalable. It's got to be more effective. Because if it's not, then it just won't get the mass adaptation. And that's what all these solutions need, is mass adaptation. And you can't change a mind. Humans just go for convenience, right? They're not just going to, people have got bigger fish to fry than picking something because it's the right choice. They need to pick something because it's the best choice. And that's what we're trying to uncover at the event.
Yeah, that word scalability is one that I've definitely like heard. It's my take home,
right.
like from this one. Can you tell us what is the one thing you wish everybody knew about the Blue Earth Summit?
The one thing I wish everybody knew about the Blue Earth Summit, probably that the one thing would be that everybody knew about the Blue Earth Summit. Because we're sitting here in our audience and a lot of people do know about it, and it creates a lot of impact. But, you know, you realise that actually the marketplace, the city, the whole area, it is just so big. And that's the challenge that we're all facing. So we can create a scaled up impact to our audience, but people have heard of the event, people within our space have heard of the event. Of course, more is gathering traction, more people are knowing about it. But yeah, I mean, as an organization, you just want as many people to know about your brand as possible and to involve as many people as possible. So I suppose I'll probably flip it a little bit like that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello, Ben.
Hi.
We know your name is Ben. Tell us your name and introduce yourself.
So I'm Ben Pollock. I'm Strategy Director for Climate Party Graphics. And we're a research design studio specialising in geospatial visualisations around climate and ecological issues.
That's a really large amount of words put all together.
It feels very professional and polished how I said that.
So tell us, I'm down in the pub, what do you do?
Oh, we make cool maps. Cool maps and nice images.
And why did you start doing that? Like, why did you suddenly think, you must care a lot about us if this is what you're doing. So where did that spark come from that you thought, I know how to do this and I know how to do this and I want to do this? Like, tell us all about your motivation.
It's been a bit of a journey. It's interesting to reflect on it. And now it's probably like a goodest time as any. So I think always had like a sort of care and concern with nature and the environment. Definitely since younger, a lot of time outside, you kind of reflect back to those sorts of moments. But then I think it's definitely more of my sort of professional career being a bit disenfranchised with some of the work that you're doing the day to day, and suddenly thinking, oh, there should be more done in these spaces. I come from a sort of design and architecture background, and wasn't feeling particularly like creatively rewarded in that, but at the same time felt some of the work you were doing was quite problematic. And so moving forward, sort of got into more sort of data and technical roles and managing information systems and everything, and that naturally lent itself to dealing with larger scale systems around climate and ecology, and suddenly started to realise, oh, we can draw like woodlands, we can draw these kind of complex systems, we can map weather in a way, we can visualise it. And so it kind of played into a sort of design background of visualising and trying to show complex things that are like not, maybe don't exist in the first instance, through to issues that I care around, I guess, around climate and ecology. So
you're a band of merry folk. So you're not alone.
Yeah. So me and my business partner John have a very similar background, for better or for worse. And yeah, I think we've been a bit of a duo in doing this, and kind of it's been a like joint exploration. I think particularly over the last 2-3 years where we've kind of waded more deeper and deeper into this space, and it's been nice not doing it alone, right? So when you have those kind of sense check moments, you're like, is this right? And we're like, no, it's good. Let's keep, like, you know, we should keep doing this. This is like, and you kind of balance each other out from those kind of crazy ebbs and flows of like, oh my God, what are we doing? To no, we've got to keep doing this. This is really sensible. And luckily we've been both out of phase in that, of being able to support one another at the time. So yeah.
Give us an example of what you do.
What we do, yeah. So we've done an interesting project. I'll speak on behalf of John for this one. So we like working or collaborating with clients that have an issue with showing what they do effectively, like visually, spatially. We've all seen sort of forestry projects, and it's a stock image of a forest, and it, you know, they tell you it's this forest, but it could kind of be anywhere. And so creating more imaginative and technical visualizations that speak specifically to that project. So for instance, one project we did was for a subsea engineering company that lay fiber optic cables. And, you know, it's really hard for what they do, because it's at the bottom of the sea, it's laying a cable in the dark, under like lots of water. And so we produced, well, John did, a sort of sectional drawing perspective of the seabed, of this cable they've laid, with all their survey data overlaying it, to celebrate, you know, the technicality of what they do, rather than like the kind of stock image of someone on the beach and this cable's coming out of the sand and there's a digger on the beach, and it's like, okay, cool. Like, you know, the project is more than that. That was one maybe more technical thing, but other aspects of trying to draw and represent ecology and give them a voice in the drawings that we do. So particularly sort of non-human narratives in drawing, connect that to wider climate stresses or factors. Thinking the global south has been a sort of bit of work that we've done over the past.
I mean, we find it hard working in weather to visualise it. So how have you gone about visualising weather and climate and what you've been doing?
Yeah, so, well, from a technical point of view, so we'll start there, is using sort of climate data sets and climate models and taking those data sets, geospatially referencing them, doing them and mapping them. But a lot of these data sets, they're actually like 3D volumetric data sets, so, and time-based. So then we have a sort of workflow that we developed of taking them, being able to effectively explode them and place them in 3D modeling environments where you can inhabit that kind of space or set up sort of perspective or views to try and articulate, say, a particular weather event or a particular phenomena. So
you're very niche.
Yes, yeah.
So, like, how do people find you? Yeah. Who's looking for you?
Yeah, this is why I guess I'm here today, right? So to do a bit of the outwards projection of everything. I guess, we've come from an academic environment, so we have quite a bit of a network of people within that, which has been quite useful so far. I guess at moments like this, you're trying to connect with people who are actually doing on-the-ground work around rewilding, forestry stuff, flooding, marine environments. So that's really exciting and been like some really productive chats today. We did have one person who said they'd come across our work, our website, which was like, how have you found us? We've only been around like a few months. Like, what, like, we need to know this because it's actually really important for us or really interesting. And the answer was like, they couldn't remember. So that's where that story goes.
How long does it take you to do a project? So you mentioned an example about laying fiber optic cable, which is insane that we are all connected in the world from these cables that sit under the sea. But how long does it, like, how much do you need to know about your client? Do you clients that you don't know? So you've mentioned a lot about data sets. You have to know a little bit of something about the atmosphere or physics to understand what you're actually looking at. So do you get clients that you have data that you don't understand? And like, how long does that whole process take? Like, what, you know?
That's a really, really good question. I think when we were doing more research-based projects, we obviously had a bit more time to indulge in the trying to really understand and ground ourselves, thinking like, some atmospheric climate science kind of stuff and understanding what the models were showing, what the data was. And I think through that we've become quite good at realizing we're not climate scientists and what's the key bits of information or the key parameters or metrics that we want to be working with within a project, or if a client has a particular issue, what data sets we can go back to that we are familiar with. Obviously the world of this stuff is changing, so there's always new data to be published in this, so it's a bit trying to keep up in that sense. But trying to, maybe for like some projects that are a bit more strategic, I guess, are maybe like a month or so, like 6 weeks, we can kind of do quite good baseline strategic modelling of stuff. But the more complex research-driven projects, possibly go on for a year, depending on like the scope or the envisioned outputs. And it might not just be like one singular thing. There might be a suite of outputs, like a big technical report, an exhibition, or this physical product that we can make and to do an exhibition with or anything like that. So
what's your feedback been on your product?
Yeah, really nice visuals is what everyone said, which is like the biggest compliment of all, because that's our, I guess, our unique selling point, or what we try and pride ourselves on and hold ourselves accountable to, really, is, does this look good? Is this visually communicating this in a way that feels appropriate, that feels sensitive to the topic, is engaging to like a technical audience, but also the layperson in that topic, they can be guided into it, to understanding it, or appreciate the complexities of it. So that's been like the best sort of compliment we've got. So
have you been surprised, or what have you been surprised by since you started? So it's a relatively new business. Clearly there's, broadly speaking, climate and mapping communications. What has surprised you the most over the last few years, aside from the person finding you in 6 months?
Maybe I was going to say that. I can't use the same joke twice. I think, some degree, the appetite or the value people have seen in the work we're doing, particularly like the last few months, have we started to put our work out there a bit more and share it with people. And the interest on it from, people who are struggling to show what they do. Like, we have a lot of appreciation for the work that people do, and we feel like we are custodians of that project work to help them show it better. And I think the appetite for that, when we started, seemed a bit vague or a bit like loose compared to more technical service offering, or people that offer like a certain product or something, and where we are offering a design service. So I think that's been the biggest surprise. I think over the last few months are there, does seem to be an appetite for this sort of thing, and that's sort of given us a bit of a rallying confidence boost, I guess.
What has brought you the most joy in the last 3 years in what you do?
I think having some of the smaller projects we've done. We did a project with Trees for Cities, who are a tree planting charity. And as part of that, there was a sort of ongoing end of project reporting mapping platform that we sort of made with them. But as part of it, we produced like this kind of printed community pamphlet. They had a sort of big community open day And I think it's really nice to see a lot of the work we do is really digital. And so to have it come down to a physical object that then seeing kids and the community and then being used in the day to kind of explain the project, I think that was the really sort of satisfying endpoint of that project. So.
And lastly, what is one thing that you wish everyone knew about what you do?
I think that presenting technical data can be sexy. It can be cool.
We think so too.
Yeah, and it can be made engaging, and that can really help, particularly mission-driven organisations that have lots of data on what they do, to further promote or communicate the good work that they're doing. So I think that's maybe the one thing.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we've a lovely little special moment because we have Hannah McGuinness, who's agreed to have a little chat to us. But she's been a moderator at this Blue Earth Summit and also at last year's Blue Earth Summit, where we met for the first time. So we've heard loads from people who are on stage talking about all of the things that are important to them. What have you learned from this? So you're on stage talking to people about climate, sustainability, businesses, people's experiences, expeditions. What have you taken away from all of this?
I think that the main thing is I spoke to Will, it was my first interview, who's the founder and CEO of Blue Earth Summit at first. And I think it's about navigating how much you can be the mavericks and the outsiders and the people who are kind of smashing it all up and trying to change the system, and how much you need to actually work within the system and accept a sort of certain system. So maybe this sounds a bit waffly, but it's the thing that I can't stop thinking about more than an answer, because actually I don't believe there are probably answers. We all try to have everything clear cut, and the thing is exploring. So I think the thing that I'm now going to go away and try and figure out is how much you could be this maverick, which is what Blue Earth is all about, and what Will wants to encourage, which is this, yes, going against the grain, smashing everything up, starting again. Like, lots of people like here are about that, but is that actually possible? Or do you have to sort of accept a certain status quo and have conversations with the people you're trying to smash their systems up? You know,
it's really interesting. We spoke to Linley, who was also one
of the founders. Lovely Linley.
Really, really interesting to talk to him as well.
There's a lot of young people at the event this year. I feel like that's a little bit of a focus. Have you noticed that? And have you think it's made a difference?
Well, I came with my dad today to make sure that the older generation was represented.
Just as important.
Really noticed that. I actually have noticed that beyond the Blue Earth Summit, which I think is a really important thing to say. So I work mostly for a thing called the How To Academy. And the audiences are just getting so much younger across all these sorts of subjects. And I just think that is just unequivocally brilliant. And I have noticed, but then I would say that compared to the things I do across the board, the Blue Earth Summit has a very young, vibrant, energetic vibe. I feel so excited walking into this venue in a way I did last year, because there's just something about it. And I couldn't put my finger on this. It's just in this warehouse, there's just so much going on, and the vibe is energetic and young and active and quite different from anything sort of, you know, corporate-y. It doesn't feel like that.
So why did you bring your dad along today?
Because actually he works for a brilliant company that makes balloons, and he's always been looking at how his, like, sustainability, he's passionate about sort of stuff in his work, and, you know, he's a beekeeper, and he's just, I think if he was doing anything else, he would have been, you know, if he hadn't done, I think he would have been David Attenborough, quite frankly. And I just thought, and he's actually about to leave his job, and I thought he would be the kind of person that would love to wander around and see about the sorts of people he could have conversations with, you know, because no one actually ever leaves their job. No one actually ever retires, definitely. So I know he'll be like itchy feet and excited about those sorts of things. And also, to be absolutely completely honest, he's just a great bit of support, and he came to listen to my talks and was in the audience. So yes, I'm very lucky. My parental support team.
I think you've
strong.
Got a lot of fans here, though. I don't know. I mean, it is nice to see a friendly face.
Yeah, I just knew it's a wonderful, amazing kind of thing that I'm involved in. You know, I think there are a lot of people who should be here. I feel really evangelical about this when I walk in. I'm really excited by it.
how long have you been talking about sustainability with your dad? So obviously you're not talking about it every day, but what I mean is it's obviously important to him. And when you say balloons, what type of balloons?
Do you know what I think is really interesting about that question? I'm not being the kind of person who says, oh, I'll take your question and I'll answer it completely separately. Yeah. But I'm only skirting the balloon issue because I think that there's a sort of, to now completely go back on the idea of everyone being here is young and that's brilliant. But then there's this, we mustn't overlook that this conversation is not new. There are lots of people like my dad who have been utterly passionate about nature. Like, if you can't find people like my dad, they are in a field listening to birds. They care about this so much. And actually, you know, I'm only thinking about this now for the first time, but there's something wonderful about that that can't be forgotten in this idea that, yes, the young are brilliant, but there are a lot of people that it's just in their, you know, it's in their DNA to like care about it. My dad loves swimming in the sea. My dad, like so many people, you know, he loves kind of fishing. I don't agree with the fishing thing because I don't want the fish to die, but you know, whatever. He loves nature and always has ever since I've known him all my life. So yes, those people exist outside of the people who've made it there. Yeah. Career or
it's really interesting you should say that because I find as well, so there was a lot of chat today about so there's a lot of focus today on young people, which is really important, and some of the chat was about business and about, you know, CEOs being over 50 and sitting in big boardrooms and them not really understanding stuff. But there is a whole generation of people that grew up in this country that know the names, you are right, of all of the birds, that know how to live within their means. They know how to live sustainably and they don't waste. They don't overuse, and they're not clicking on shopping and you know.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, you know, it's people like my dad who now I love is sort of representing. He's the one who'll stop everyone in the house and say, "That's the recycling bin. This is that," because they care passionately. It's like a deep ingrained thing. They're not on Instagram, and they're not on X. It's called X for the first time ever. You know, they're not on TikTok. It is a wonderful thing, the movement, but it, yes, we should probably remember more, shouldn't we, that it's like deeply ingrained in everyone's psyche, or most, not everyone, of course, but it's deeply ingrained in a kind of a...
Well, the climate conversation isn't new at all. It's just the social media has probably made it feel really new, but your dad's probably been having that kind of conversation since it started coming out in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s and everything. Maybe we should get your dad on the podcast as well and have a chat to
him. We're making him sound like he's also hilariously young. I mean, he literally looks the same age as me and has the attitude of, you know, he didn't stand out here remotely. He hasn't got a grey hair on his head. It's quite unfair.
Hannah, thank you so much for talking to
us
today.
We got the music.
Yeah, I know. It's just started on in the background. We hope you've enjoyed these little mini podcasts from the Blue Earth Summit at Woolwich. We've had a great time, learned loads, got to speak to many cool people. Thanks to everybody who talked to us, and most importantly, thanks very much for listening to the podcast and supporting us.
We hope you leave this episode
loving the weather, but a little bit more.